Bonsoir.
Bonsoir. What does bonsoir have to do with it?
I don't know.
Okay, it's not quite bonsoir yet.
No, it just
unless you didn't get to bed yet. since it's time to wish.
We didn't party at all.
On the menu, listeners, a Merry New Year or a Happy New Year or whatever it is.
Yeah, 2012 is going to be a very good year.
Yeah, last night was the night of Saint Sylvester, isn't it, in France?
I don't know.
It's a day that's celebrated all over the world in different kinds of ways, and I'm sure you had a good time, and I hope you're ready for an exciting new 2012. And we're starting off the year in an extraordinarily exotic destination. Because we're talking all about Morocco with some people who are from there and some people who just like it there. And in general, covering the subject of a really fascinating type of food that not only can you eat at restaurants, but you can also fix for yourself thanks to the people who are guests on today's program.
And, you know, I mean, I just woke up to a trend after about the fourth book
you just
on
woke
Moroccan
up.
Food. Came across my desk.
There we go.
It's one of the hot cuisines. People keep talking about Korean, and I'm sure it is, but Moroccan is too.
And
now, I might say that we have remind us one major author.
She did a great book too, and she'll talk to us about that in due course. But Murad Lalou, I'm not pronouncing exactly correctly, I'm sure, grew up in Morocco, but did all of his cooking in the United States, and he has an exciting restaurant in San Francisco with two Michelin stars called Aziza, and a cookbook to go along with it so that you can cook the wonderful delights that he does. So let's listen to him first up.
I really think I've fallen in love with Chef Murad Lalou. Is that pronounced correctly?
That's correct.
Yeah, your book is just beautiful. Your restaurant is Aziza. You are from Morocco, and this is called New Moroccan, which defines the cuisine that you do. I just fell in love with this book because what you do actually is capture sort of the soul and the essence of this whole style of cooking, which has become all of a sudden, I don't know why, so terribly popular.
Well, this new wave of Moroccan cooking is really cool, and I think it's something that a lot of people have embraced over the last few years, and there are a lot of people who are trying to basically incorporate Moroccan flavors into their cooking, and they're not necessarily Moroccan cooks, and that is what's really intriguing, is the fact that there are American chefs and Italian chefs and French chefs who are cooking in the United States, who are embracing these flavors, and I think they add a lot of dimensions to their food and to their cooking, and it opens up a lot of doors to their repertoire.
Yeah, but we've always used some of these seasonings and the spices and so forth, but you get to a whole different level in this cookbook and the way you approach this food.
Well, basically, Moroccan food is based on a lot of layers of flavors. You build the flavors, so when you make it, you actually build in flavors one on top of the other. So when you're actually eating the food, you might encounter so many flavor profiles as you eat in one dish. And what I've tried to do is really deconstruct that and make the flavor not be muddled and not be cluttered in a dish and clean up the profile that I use when I make food. So you really have to have a really delicate hand with the spices. But the one thing that I really was trying to achieve with the book was that I don't want it to be chefy. I don't want it to be a book that is just for chefs. I want it to be a book that anybody can cook out of. And we made it such that it's fairly simple, and it's very straightforward, and it's not something that you need to have. I'm also trying to make home cooks become better cooks. We were talking before, people, if they were pushed a little bit to become better cooks, they can embrace new techniques, and they can try to make food at home that is not the dishes that they've been used to making. And I think that makes for a great experience to be able to eat at home at night rather than going out to restaurants on a weekly basis. I think cooking at home is really important, and I think cooking at home is something that is crucial to families, and I think it's the glue that basically keeps families together and conversations going on every night, and people can talk about food, can talk about menus, can talk about...
Oh, I loved your stories about growing up.
Yeah, I mean, it's just that was part of life, and I never realized how important it was until I came to the United States. When I lost that asset, and that part of my day where people would sit together around the table and discuss food, and it was just like, to me, at the time when I was growing up, it was something that was annoying, because it was basically the same conversations that we were having every day. But then when you lose that and you come here and you're not having those conversations anymore and you know, you don't have the same people nagging about their favorite food and what they want to eat and what they want to make every day, you kind of realize that that conversation, that time that we spend around the table talking about food from the moment we wake up was really the glue that kept us together around that table. And that was really, really important. And I kind of missed that when I came to the United States.
Now, you left your... So your family is still in Morocco.
Everybody's still in Morocco.
Now, yeah. were you a chef when you came here already?
Absolutely not. I never, ever cooked in any professional kitchen. And I've never been to cooking school before I opened my first restaurant. I opened my first restaurant and I basically had no menu because I had no idea what I was going to make.
Well, you and your brother, I talk about guts.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it was just...
What you didn't know you were getting into, huh?
Absolutely. And I think that was my biggest asset because if I had known what it took to run a restaurant or to open a restaurant or to actually make money from the restaurant business, I would have never done it. And that's the honest truth. It was that ignorance that basically helped me just go for it and jump in head first.
Now, you're a little bit like Charlie Fan then from The Slanted Door.
Absolutely. I mean, we started out...
And you're friends too, right?
We're really close friends. And actually, he's in the back cover of the book. He gave me...
Oh, I thought that was so funny. What did he say? Something about...
Just talking about how looks can be deceiving, but, you know, the food has a lot of flavor, and we managed to capture the soul of the cuisine. That was really awesome that we were able to give up that.
Of course, I mean, you are very good looking, and you're posed throughout the book. That's the part of what's going to sell it.
Very subjective, but thank you for the compliment.
Now, your grandfather was a big part of your growing up, and you used to shop with him, so you have all those memories. In fact, you dedicate the book to him. You say, to my grandpa, Haj Ben Sadik.
Yes.
Still and always my loving guide, my voice, my values, the barometer of my soul, and the true author of my story.
Yes.
And then we launch in, as we were talking before, that what you really built your concept of food and your menus around was, I mean, men didn't cook when you were growing up in Morocco. You built it around something you called memories.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about what memories are to you.
Basically, my grandpa was the biggest influence of my life, just in terms of values and morals, but in terms of what it took to be a good human being. And he was basically the strength and the guiding force for me when I was growing up. I looked up to him. He was my friend, and that was really important. He was not just somebody who was being strict with me and telling me about the lesson life and that there are no shortcuts, but he was basically my best friend, and I loved hanging out with him. And the fact that he would take me to the market with him in the morning and shop, but in a way he was deciding what to make for lunch and for dinner through his shopping, but it was actually the women. They held the biggest part of that whole equation. It was not a situation where women had a second voice. They had the biggest and the first voice in the kitchen and in the family. And
yeah, but you said he was the executive chef because he did the decision.
Basically made the decisions, but it was the women who decided how to make it. And I talk about this many occasions where it was my grandma, it was my mom, it was my aunt that basically decided how that food was going to be made, how it was going to be processed that day. I mean, even if they get something that they did not feel like cooking that day, they would literally manipulate that whole situation and end up making what they wanted to make. and that was really beautiful to watch. They really had a lot of power and they had a lot of say in what was going on in the family.
You know, you have a lot of help for the starting out, beginning cook here with the spices and your description of that. I think it's probably the recipe that I'm going to use for the rest of my life for preserved lemons, too, because I've never had good, I mean, most places tell you to throw them out after a month.
Yeah.
And you said,
I mean,
no.
If there's one recipe that I really want people to get out of cookbook, it's preserved lemons. I think they're so wonderful, and I think they really change the way people cook. Flavor is completely different than regular lemons.
Oh, yeah.
When people think about preserved lemons and they look at the ingredient list, it's basically lemons and salt, and say, well how much is that going to change? It's completely different. It becomes a lemon that you can eat directly out of the jar. Bitter, it's sweeter, it's sour, it's so complex, and it adds so much depth and different flavor to food than you can possibly expect.
But see, I always suspected that in Morocco, they kept them for longer than just 1 month.
Well, absolutely, but I mean, 1 month is the minimum for me.
Right.
And I use them, but they get better and better. They get stronger, and it's just like wine. They mature with time. And we had preserved lemons for over a year. These are lemons that were, we take them out of the jars, and so syrupy, like they're so thick. The juice becomes so thick and syrupy. It's amazing what happens to them, and I think it's really intriguing what people can do with them. And they're so versatile. I mean, you can use them in so many different ways, like as a puree, as a little pieces that you can throw in a salad. You can use them in stews. I mean, they're just so versatile as far as what you can do with them.
Well, you know, I love your stories. I laughed so hard through that. Is it called Warka?
Yeah.
I thought that was so funny.
It's really wonderful, yeah. And I think the whole book is based on those memories. And as I was saying earlier, it's all about, like, you sit down and you really start to think. You have to recreate in your mind all those moments that you spend watching people cook in Morocco, and you figure out the recipe from those moments. So the cooking part becomes the second plot. It's not what's going on before your eyes, but the cooking part becomes the subplot of the story, and that's what I try to capture. That's what I try to pay attention to. And we were talking earlier about, like, dreams and how they're in black and white, and that's what it is with food. When I think about food from back home, don't think about it in terms of colors. You know, it's not so sharp and clear. This is not a flat screen TV that we're talking about. This is just like shadows of things. These are like, there's so much room for interpretation. There's so much room for, like, is it really that gray? Was it that black? Or is it that white? And you just have these three colors, black, white, and gray, that you're dealing with. And you can make so much out of these three colors than you can possibly imagine. And it just shadows what's happening that you try to capture, and you need to put your own personal touch and twist on things when you get them. It's not clear cut. And this is like something that I talk about when it comes to, like, Moroccan food. Some people say, you know what, how can you call what you do Moroccan food, because this is not the kind of food that I had in Morocco. But my answer to that is just, this is my own interpretation on Moroccan food. I never, ever felt that anybody could make, even the Moroccans who cook professionally in America, I don't think they can possibly make Moroccan food the way it's made in Morocco. It's impossible. Food is something that has to have a sense of place. I mean,
yes,
food tastes a certain way in Italy because it's consumed in Italy. It's the sight, it's the visual, it's the smells, it's the light, it's everything. It's the voices that you hear when you're eating that food. That's what makes that experience so unique. You can't just export that all the way across the world and put it in the middle of town that has absolutely nothing to do with Italy and call that authentic Moroccan food or authentic Italian food or authentic anything. I think people, when they come to America and they start cooking from their homelands, it's basically an interpretation of what they had before. And I felt like the ingredients were not the same. I felt like lamb did not taste the same here in America as it did in Morocco, nor should it. It's a completely different environment. It's a completely different way of raising animals. And I think real cooks will have to understand that and realize, you know what, we're shooting ourselves in the foot if we claim that we are making food the way it was made from where we came from. You are making food that is just an interpretation of that. Make food that makes sense to where you live. So if I'm living in San Francisco, I'm making food that makes sense, that has a sense of place to where I am, and that is San Francisco. It has some roots in Moroccan cuisine. It has a foundation, and that's where I go. That's where I start from. But as far as the whole dish, as if you look at it, it has a little bit of San Francisco in it. It has a lot of the Bay Area in it. But it also has Moroccan flavors in there. It has Moroccan technique in there. It has flavors that are combined in a way that makes it Moroccan. But I think it's really hard for anybody to claim that they're making Moroccan food in the middle of America and they're not in Morocco. Because I remember when I was eating food in, you know, have you guys been to Marrakesh?
No.
Okay, Marrakesh has this big square in the middle of the city, and it's like street food. It's like every night when the sun goes down, all these stands like come to life, and you have all this smoke, and you have all these people like walking around. And it's like a really huge place to go to, and anybody who goes to Marrakesh has to go to this place because it's at the center of the city. But when you eat something there, you are soaking in not just the food. You're not just tasting the food. You're tasting everything around you, and that's what makes it so special. But merely taking that food and bringing it to the middle of San Francisco or New York or Atlanta and eating the same exact food, it's not going to taste the same, because there's so much more to food than just what goes through your mouth. There's so much more, and I think people have to understand that, and people have to be honest with what they can do with Moroccan food outside of Morocco. And that's when I realized that for me to be honest with what I do, I have to tell people that I'm making them an interpretation of what I think Moroccan food is. It's not Moroccan food that you would have in Morocco, but it's just an interpretation.
Now, you have two things going for you, though, two things that people are going to learn through this book. One of them is technique, which you mentioned. So the technique would include, I guess, using dishes like the tagine to make braises. And the other is a portfolio of spices.
Exactly.
So those two things are common between Moroccan food in Morocco and Moroccan food as you cook it in San Francisco and as people will learn how to cook it through this book.
Yeah, but that is true, but the ironic thing is, if you really want to understand the virtues of a tagine, basically you cannot use a tagine in America that is not glazed. You cannot use a tagine in America that is used in Morocco because of health issues. The health department would not allow anybody cooking professionally to use an unglazed tagine because the juices from the meat and the spices and the sauces will basically go into the pores of the tagine. And
I never thought of that, actually.
And basically they say, you know, it's a health hazard because the bacteria can be developed there, and then when you cook with the tagine the next time, that bacteria might go into the food and make people sick. I've never heard of anybody getting sick from eating from a tagine in Morocco, but the concerns are understandable. So that one... And that is one thing that I want to say about tagines in Morocco. You can literally take a tagine that's been seasoned for 20, 30 years and people have been cooking in it for that long and literally put plain water in it and simmer it for 15, 20 minutes. And that water will become flavor. It will become like a broth. So if you're using a glazed tagine, you take that whole concept out of the equation. And that is really sad. So that's one issue. The second issue is that the tagine is like, to me, as far as I'm concerned, is the first circulator that has been used that I know of. Because basically you're creating a temperature inside the tagine that, because of the shape of the lid, the conical shape of the lid, it circulates steam from the top to the bottom. It keeps going up and down, up and down. And that is just from the mere shape of the vessel that you're cooking into. That is really smart. That is so ingenious. And when I figured that out, I was really blown away by that concept. So, yeah, I mean, the technique and the utensils that you're using are there. But as far as the restaurant is concerned, what we're talking about when we're talking about new techniques is Moroccan food does not evolve. When you go to Morocco and you eat food, and if you happen to go to Morocco over so many years, you end up eating the same food over again.
That's like Greece.
Exactly. And there's a reason for that. We don't embrace change when it comes to food. We want our food to remind us of past times. We want our food to remind us of situations where we were with our families and we were like having these great meals, and those are happy times. And when we get together around a table and we laugh and we eat, we want to remember those moments. So when we cook, we tend to recreate those moments by making food that we've consumed before. And that is really crucial because that's the way we look at great food in Morocco. The best cooks in Morocco are those who can preserve tradition. They're the ones who can make couscous the way it's been made for the last 500 years. And when somebody like would take a bite out of a tagine or eat a spoonful of couscous, and it reminds them of a moment where the whole family was getting together and they were having this one wonderful meal, then to them, that's excellent. Here in America, it's more looking forward. The visionaries of American cooking are just people who embrace things that are from other countries, ingredients that originated from other countries. Like, you see American chefs cooking with soy sauce and cooking, you know, serving a lot of raw fish like the Japanese do. You see a lot of people serving with targa. And these are American chefs, but those are visionaries. Those are people but they're looking outwards. And I wanted to do that with Moroccan food.
I think that you're generally recognized in the whole culinary, I mean, like across the country and even globally, as somebody with that kind of a spirit of being able to, how would we describe it? You distill all of the Moroccan experience.
What I was trying to say is that there's a place for the traditional Moroccan food. I love that kind of, but I think it's kind of sad that we're limiting ourselves to just that way of cooking. I think if we incorporate other ingredients and technique into the traditional stuff, I think we can come up with something that is really unique. Everything evolves in life, and food should evolve as well. We're taking people telling me, you know, where's the romance cooking with an immersion circulator? Where's the romance in cooking in a plastic bag? But I tell those people, romance is in what you put in your mouth. I mean, the flavors are better. They're cleaner. The meats are so much more flavorful if they're cooked sous vide. Not everything is meant to be cooked sous vide, but it's really important for things when they're reinterpreted. that they become better. I don't want to change things just for the sake of changing them, but I want to change them for the sake of making them better, making them more approachable.
Well, you have this whole section. I thought it was a very clear example of how you evolved into this, because you opened this restaurant and you weren't used to having desserts.
Oh, absolutely. I mean,
you have a whole section on
desserts. If you have any Moroccan meal, when you finish like a huge meal, and usually it's lunch, you end the meal with a lot of fruit, just fresh fruit. There's no manipulation of fruit. There's no purees. There's no custard. There's no chocolate. Basically, you end the meal with fresh fruit, and that is wonderful. But I think it's really cool to take that idea and to try to change it a little bit. And yeah, you can serve fruit, but instead of just serving a wedge of watermelon every day for 3 or 4 weeks, maybe you can take that watermelon and make a granita with it. So much more refreshing, and it's different. So it's not doing away with the old style, but it's just taking it a little bit further.
I want to ask you, you're doing, of course, your book tour, and you're cooking at a restaurant in Atlanta. What dishes, I mean, you're cooking from your book, what dishes did you select for your menu tonight?
We have a bunch of small bites. Basically, to start, we're serving a cracker, a rice cracker with smoked roe and urfa pepper and Greek yogurt that has been seasoned on preserved lemon. So that's one bite. We also are serving, the first course of the meal would be a scallop dish with the berber,
okay,
plant with cauliflower and vadovan butter and raisin. That is basically my interpretation on a Moroccan dish where we served a fish stew with a lot of cauliflower. The scallop become really overcooked in a stew. So what we're doing is we're taking the scallop out of the dish, we're crusting them with the berber, and then we're pan searing them. And they have this beautiful crust, but they're still tender and they're still like so flavorful. And the spice from the vadovan does not overwhelm
them. Yeah, no, that's French, right?
What is French?
The vadovan.
Vadovan is basically a French version of curry. What they've done is told the story in the book. The French, you know, they love curry, but they thought it was very overwhelming. It just dominates the dishes that they use, you know, curry in. So they incorporated a lot of fried shallot and fried garlic. And when that happens, basically, it just mellows out the flavors of the curry. And it's a wonderful thing. It's really a clever way of using the spices of the curry without having to deal with that potency of the spices. So that's going to be one dish. The second dish will braised beef cheeks with brown butter couscous, carrot jam.
Oh boy, does that sound good.
And it's just a wonderful thing. And that's really a traditional dish. We would serve couscous with a lot of overcooked vegetables and
which is what it calls for, yeah.
Exactly. And braised, you know, beef or lamb. And we serve that alongside a little side of harissa. But the way I've done it, and when you cook it in the traditional way, what ends up happening is like everything starts to taste the same. The couscous, the beef, the harissa, the vegetables, everything starts to taste the same. Everything starts to taste the same, which is fine. But what I wanted to do is deconstruct that so people, when they're eating my dish, they should be able to taste the couscous by itself. They should be able to taste the beef, because if it's really good quality beef, I want to be able to taste that, and that's something that is really important to me. I don't want the harissa to overwhelm everything and make everything hot. So I make it in the form of an emulsion that basically is, the heat is there, but it's not overwhelming. And it becomes part of the sauce. It's not just something that you dump into the couscous. It's not sriracha, you know. It's not something that you, if you're using great ingredients, why you want to overwhelm them with such tremendous amounts of heat that you don't taste the ingredients anymore? So
you're encouraging me to actually launch in and try some of these recipes.
We hope so.
Fabulous.
I think that's the point of writing the book. I mean,
ever thought of pickled green strawberries?
They're so wonderful. I remember when I first, it was an accident basically, when we first started using green strawberries. I deal with a farmer, Joe, from Dirty Girl. His farm is called Dirty Girl Farms. And basically, he grows some of the best strawberries in the Bay Area. I remember the first of the strawberries 1 year, half the flat was basically green. And when I took it to the restaurant and I looked at it, it's like, what am I going to do with these green strawberries? I'm not going to wait for them to ripen. So I used the red ones for desserts and for the typical applications that you can think of when it comes to strawberries. But the green ones, I tasted them. They had this wonderful crunchy texture. They were kind of like sour. We tried to do a lot of things with them, and then pickled was really a solution that so beautifully. And we also used them in a stew because they were firmer and they would not fall apart when you cook them. So heat did not really affect them that much. And when we realized that, we started making stews out of them. They worked so beautifully, and they became a little bit like celery or artichoke, and they held their shape, which was great.
These are wonderful recipes.
Yeah, before we sign off, I have a bone to pick.
What?
That's not a Moroccan expression. It's an English expression, I guess. But I have a bone to pick with you. First of all, I already started cooking dinner for tonight, and I'm probably going to have to throw it out and start over again. But in return for that, I hope we'll have the opportunity to really experience Murad for ourselves.
And this is a beautiful cookbook.
The next time we're in San Francisco.
Yeah, and congratulations on this wonderful cookbook. And I just think people get inspired just by looking at it and hopefully cooking from it as well.
Well, I know, and thank you so much, and I really want to make sure that people get this idea that just by doing little things, by building your pantry, by making preserved lemons, by making rasa hanout, by buying spices fresh and using them in the proper way, it will make you a better cook. This is not a book.
Yeah, I told Peter we're throwing out all our spices and we're starting to toast them.
Please do that, because if you're just using old spices, you really are not getting the benefit of what they can do to food.
I can't put up with any more revolutionary ideas.
Maybe this is a good excuse for another chat sometime down the road, so we can influence you to do more things.
That'd be great.
It's really a great way of cooking at home and getting your family together and making everybody part of the process. It's not just like people are just showing up for dinner and they just sit down and eat, but it's really important for people to get together and cook together and talk about their days, and it's really a wonderful thing, and I think that's been missing from the American family, and it would be wonderful if everybody did their part in getting that back and making that an important aspect of who we are as human beings again. I think that would be
But you're certainly great. Doing your job in this, and have a really successful dinner tonight.
Thank you so much, and hopefully we'll get to cook for you one day.
And we'll talk to you soon again, I'm hoping.
Thank you so much, and
thanks for having
me on.
Thank you, Murad. I can't wait to start cooking from this book, and he's not so bad to look at either. It's time to take a break.
Yeah, right. I think we better not go any further on that subject. It is indeed time to take a break, and we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And the next up, actually, is a totally different take on Moorish, which is called Moorish Fusion.
Moorish Fusion. But this is an interesting guy, too, because he didn't stop when he got to San Francisco. He just kept on going.
He kept on going
west and finished up in Hawaii. I'm not really sure I entirely understand the reason for that. But anyway, he's got a fascinating story to tell about fusion, Moroccan.
We're talking to Zuhair Zahri. Zuhair, welcome to On the Menu. Where are you now?
I am in Tokyo, Japan.
You are in Tokyo. Okay. Well, I didn't remember if you would come back or not. I guess Peter had asked you that question. Do you live in Japan part of the time?
No. I live on Maui, and then my wife is Japanese, and then we come here and live part-time so our youngest son can learn the language. So we enroll him in the school.
Oh, what a great idea. That's great. And your book is called Moorish Fusion Cuisine, and it's called Conquering the New World. Why the subtitle? What does that mean?
Well, the Moors, as you know, they conquered the lands of Spanish, Berber, Arabs, and the subtitle was it's like a catchphrase to catch people's attention.
Okay.
So what I'm doing with my cuisine is just, it's all ancient ingredients, and then I'm using them in a new way in the 21st century.
Now, is this kind of cooking style actually developing in Morocco as well, or did North Africa still stay very traditional?
It's still pretty traditional. 99% is traditional.
Now, we are going to be interviewing soon a chef who's in San Francisco, who has a restaurant called Aziza.
And he does modernize.
And he's Moroccan, and he's doing a modern take on Moroccan. Do you know him at all?
No, I do not know him at all. But I've read an article in the New York Times, I think, about a week ago, and it was something about Aziza in San Francisco, and one of the famous all our waffles. I think she put the Moroccan cuisine, you know, she opened the eyes of the Western world to Moroccan cuisine.
Years ago, and this is an update, but it's still, her goal is to preserve the traditional Moroccan cuisine, whereas the other author we're talking about from Aziza, the chef from Aziza, is actually presenting sort of a new take, a new style altogether on Moroccan cuisine.
Which is a little bit like what you're doing as well.
Well, in a way, because I don't call myself as a Moroccan cuisine, because I use Moroccan ingredients, influenced by my classical training in French cuisine, and then with the area that I've lived from the United States around the world, my travels, and I just infuse them with ingredients. So when I say fusion, I don't use, even though certain dishes are inspired by my love for sushi, but I use Mediterranean ingredients as olive oil, citrus to flavor that food.
Right, but you do sushi. You have a lot of respect for Japanese cuisine, as you said.
Yes, I don't do sushi. I do it as like a crudo, which is a fresh roll style, almost like a ceviche style. So the olive oil and then the acid of the juice of the citrus kind of cure the meat a little bit.
Right.
While the Japanese cuisine, they use shoyu or soy sauce.
I asked you before, but I don't know that we resolved this. I said that in the past month, we have received four cookbooks targeting Moroccan cuisine. And I wondered why all this sudden interest in Moroccan food.
Well, I mean, Morocco has a long history, maybe because of the media. I mean, certain films have been filmed and been given big press in Morocco. And maybe Morocco now is back on the map, but Moroccan cuisine has been really flourished and known, and its unique ingredients and aromas, maybe that's why people are into it more.
I love it, absolutely love it. My mother loved Morocco, too. In fact, I have, back to the days when people smoked, I have a Mamoumia Hotel ashtray.
That's one of the best. That hotel is rated one of the top 10 in the world.
Yeah, well, she liked it. I know that. She stayed there several times.
We hope the statute of limitations has expired.
after this ashtray.
In any event, they won't be able to...
Well, no, they renovated the hotel, but I think about 4 or 5 years ago, so maybe they have a brand new ashtray or 20% ashtray.
I don't think they need ashtrays at all. You know, I think the photography is pretty startling in this book. I'm right now looking at this chicken. The opening page to your poultry and game section. It looks like somebody I should know, this chicken.
Well, actually, the one thing about the book that I would like to give credit, of course, to my whole team, but the photographer is an amazing photographer. Everything you see on that book, even though we have a stylus, none of the recipes have anything fake on it. No chemicals, no nothing.
Yeah, well, that's good.
What you see on the pictures is what we ate after the photo shoot. The chicken, actually, it's a live chicken, and it's from across the street from the farm in Maui, where I got all my organic vegetables, or at least most of my organic vegetables.
So did the chicken survive the experience of being photographed, and it didn't become dinner?
Well, no, it didn't become dinner for my book, no, but it did, it was a challenging. It took like 30 minutes to get the pose for the chicken, you know, to get that picture.
No, we had a funny conversation just like 2 or 3 weeks ago in Ireland, and this particular property we were visiting was a cookery school, and they also had a farm, and they had chickens, and the chef called them his girls. And he told us, which is something that we didn't really entirely understand, that chickens lay eggs throughout the year, and when they're younger, they produce more eggs. As they get older, he said, they get kind of lazy. They don't produce as many eggs. So he said eventually they become stock.
it does, pretty much.
So we wondered if this guy became stock.
No, this guy was just like, we used him as a portrait. I mean, I wanted something after finishing up the recipes, we took pictures of insert pictures. And I didn't want to buy them from the internet. I just wanted the book to be as real as possible, and to have a story behind it to the reader.
It's a very fine-looking chicken.
Yes. Now, I'm looking at this recipe, which is very attractive. It's the deep-fried cauliflower with saffron batter. I've never heard of saffron batter, but isn't that a great idea?
Well, that's my take. You know, growing up, I mean, I've lived in the United States. I mean, I grew up in the United States and I matured in the United States. I left home at a very young age. So after so many years, I guess as I'm getting older, I get to miss my hometown and my home cooking. And when I was doing the book, I was thinking of, you know, appetizers, I mean, what things I grew up with. And one of the items that my mom used to make is fried cauliflower. But my mom's cauliflower always was kind of like burned on one side, light on the other side. So what I was trying to do with this one is trying to, as I'm making the book for the home cook, I always have the professional touch of the chef for presentation and elegance. So the batter will hold that the crust on the cauliflower.
It sounds, your mother's cauliflower sounds a little bit like my mother's cauliflower. So you were not exactly taught your cooking at the apron strings of your mother.
No, I didn't. No, I think that's probably, you know, in the blood, because my grandmother, God rest her soul, and my aunt, they were one of the best chefs I've ever known or, you know, I've ever met in my life.
So it was in the family?
Yes, it's definitely in the family, yeah. It's all from my mom's side. To my mother.
But, you know, you deviate from tradition in some dishes where it's just the creativity that comes out. I'm looking at lavender-crusted tuna with saffron, white beans, and argan oil.
Well, that dish, when I think of tuna, I think of tuna as like a meat. So I like the white beans. One of my favorite dishes my mom makes is lamb and white beans.
Oh,
and,
me too.
So when I think of tuna, people, you know, it's overrated, the tuna sashimi or tuna crudo. So I wanted to use tuna because of the island of Maui, and then, of course, the Mediterranean. We have plenty of tuna there, and then Maui is very well known for its tuna. And I wanted to give it, not to overcook it, because if you cook tuna, it's like eating your own shoe. And then the lavender, I mean, I have a lot of lavender across the farms from me in Maui, and there's a lot of lavender in Morocco, so I combine that. So it adds a flavor to the tuna. I just give it a little hint, and the saffron bean is because, you know, I treat the tuna as a meat, or I think of it as a more meaty fish.
We're cooking tuna tonight. Who knows? Who knows what will become of it?
Well, our lavender is pretty much gone.
I think
leaves,
so, yeah.
But we don't have any
balloons. If I go back to Maui, I always can send you a few sprigs of lavender.
Yeah, no, the argan oil I love, but I can't afford it.
Well, actually, I mean, you know, nowadays with the website, and I get my argan oil, I mean, I got it, of course, from Morocco, but also when I need it, like when I need it for the cookbook, because of the shipping, it's very hard to ship liquid and with the customs and stuff. I get it from a website called Zamuri Spices. I think they're based somewhere in the Midwest of the United States, and they guarantee the product and it comes, you know, all nicely packaged. Of course, if you translate the amount of money you spend on a small bottle versus what in Morocco, you're paying 10 times the price, but it's really worth it.
Yeah, well, see, I found there's a big difference between organic, premium argan oil and the stuff that they sell here. I had some really awful stuff. I don't know. Remember Tony used to use that?
Yeah, you turned him onto it because we met someone who was selling argan oil at the Borough Market in London probably almost a decade ago.
Yeah.
And she was trying to represent the women who picked the nuts, which is apparently quite a chore.
It is quite a chore. I mean, and that's now with the use of the argan oil and the popularity of it, they use it for both, I mean, cosmetic and then for culinary. So there's two types of argan oil.
Oh, so there are two different kinds. So.
Well, I mean, not kinds. I mean, it's one kind of argan oil. Let me rephrase that. And then what happens is they use it for both, you know, they can derive culinary oil from it, and then they can use other certain parts for cosmetic also.
Well, see, well, I mean, I noticed when we got really prized organic oil, it was really so much better and so much different. Now, here we have, I guess, one of your most famous flavors in fruit is your braised oxtail you do with pomegranate molasses, golden raisins, and toasted sesame seeds. Now, that, to me, sounds Moroccan.
In a way, it does, because when I created it, I had the Moroccan flavors in mind, but also the Moorish, because with the Moors, how they opened up the world to the agriculture when they planted the pomegranates, the artichokes, and so on. So when I was making that, my wife is one of my wife's favorite dish, And that picture, actually, she styled it herself when she was helping doing the cookbook. So, you know, the pomegranate, you know, it has that sweet and tangy flavor. And then, of course, I use honey in that. And it's one of the delicious dishes you've ever had, you know. And then all the recipes in the book, if you follow step by step, you will get the same result as in the pictures.
Well, yes, I mean, I want to apologize. I slip into it, but I know that I should not be using Moroccan in place of Moorish, because Moorish is the more specific meaning.
Yes, but it's okay, because, I mean, you know, that Moroccan Moorish, I mean, it's pretty much, you know, just the Moors, you know, once they left Spain, they settled, you know, 99% in Morocco. So.
Oh, okay, so it was sort of coming back.
Yes. Yeah, so they came back.
It wasn't going over. It was coming back several centuries later.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't realize
that. Now, here's
that.
Something. Like, do you remember when I used to make this couscous with lamb shank and
I do. I do remember that, yes.
Zucchini, I used to use it. Yes. Zucchini and carrots. There I love go. That. Why don't we do that soon?
What, lamb shanks?
Well, couscous. I'd like the couscous.
You like couscous?
I don't have one of those wonderful pots, though. I always wanted a couscousier.
I can always use a double boiler.
That's what I use.
A couscousier, so.
Oh, yeah, I never did buy one of the specific ones, and I still managed. But boy, did I love that dish. I wish we'd made it more often.
But the good thing about the couscous is the reason I cook it at home, because so we can eat more vegetables. You know, so tasty with all the seven vegetables. And, you know, the couscous without seven vegetables. I grew up. This is what it's like a grandmother's tale. You have to have at least seven vegetables to be called a couscous. So.
Oh, I didn't know that. Tell me that again. You have to have seven vegetables?
Yeah, seven vegetables. You know, there's two types of couscous. There's a sweet couscous as a dessert.
Yeah.
Actually, there's three types of couscous. There's a couscous with the seven vegetables. You can use either meat or chicken. Some people use fish. I've never had couscous with fish. And there's a second couscous with caramelized onions and raisins. You can use either beef or lamb. And there's a third couscous, which is couscous with cinnamon and powdered sugar. So my, grandmother growing up, the couscous, it's not a couscous if it doesn't have at least seven vegetables.
Oh, that's good. I didn't know that. But, but this is wonderful, the chickpeas and... Oh, it's beautiful. So, anyhow, what's next for you? Are you working on more Japanese-style food?
No, really. At the moment, I'm going after... I have two more weeks left in Tokyo, and I will leave on November for cookbook signing tour. I will be going to Houston. I have two book signing events there. One is in Barnes & Noble, and one in one of my friend's restaurants and business partner. And then I go to Arizona for two book signings. My assistant in the book, he's the executive chef of two restaurants. And then we're going to do one book signing event there, and another book signing at Barnes & Noble. And then I head back to Maui for a book signing event. And then after that, it's just promoting the book, and I try to reach as much as customers as possible. And hopefully, the next year, I'll be starting on the next book.
Wow. Okay. Well, what will it be this time?
I have two ideas. One idea is going to be about fish. And I love fish and seafood. And with the Japanese culture coming here often, they use ingredients that we take for granted in other worlds. And the fish, I mean, as everybody knows now, and that's the reason why the sushi is so popular, because of the health and nutrition behind the fish. So my take is I want to write a book instead of the Japanese ingredients that is very hard to find in Morocco or the Mediterranean. I want to use, fish ingredients that are available to us in the Mediterranean with my own style. So another fusion, but just bringing up, just making a bridge for both worlds to use ingredients with, other ingredients.
Well, you must be sure to let us know when this project is coming to fruition so we can invite you back. And
I will definitely love to be back.
And thank you so much for calling us all the way from Japan.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, and after the break, we're going to talk specifically about a cooking pot that's essential to Moroccan cuisine, the tagine. So,
and it's also the style of the dish. The tagine is the style of dish.
Sure, so stay with us so you can learn about that too.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Okay, we're back.
And you are going to be rewarded for staying with us by talking to Pat Crocker all about every conceivable form of tagine you would ever imagine.
Pat Crocker, you must have a lot of fun. You've written on such a variety of subjects, the juicing Bible, the smoothies Bible, the vegetarian cook's Bible, the vegan cook's Bible, the yogurt Bible, and now you give us 150 best tagine recipes. Welcome to On the Menu, Pat Crocker.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I asked you earlier, and you gave me a really an exciting answer, about what, after all these other books, drove you to write a tagine cookbook?
Well, I had the great fortune to visit Istanbul, and I spent a number of days, actually I went back every day, to the spice market, and I experienced wonderful flavors when I was there. A few myths were busted because people think of Moroccan or Algerian or Middle Eastern foods as being very hot and spicy. And in actual fact, they're not. They're spicy, yes, but they're balanced spice, which is a beautiful balance and it's a beautiful blend. So I spent a lot of time in the spice market wandering around and looking at spice blends. And when
do they let you taste these?
They do. You're right in the stalls with the spice sellers. And, of course, each spice seller has his own blend, be that a Ras El Hanout, which actually literally means top of the shop. In other words, the best that spice seller has to sell. Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Oh, it's really phenomenal. And over the years, I would imagine that each spice seller has gained a reputation of his own, and individual families sort of purchase their spices and spice blends from their favorite spice sellers.
When you are, in addition to being a cookbook author and a home economist, and you're a culinary herbalist, which you said you defined that term, actually. But in your introduction to the herbs and spices of the North African flavor footprint, you list the taste, then you use culinary use, and then the medicinal aspect of it, too, because most of these herbs and spices have a medicinal use.
Absolutely. You know, I'm just looking at chili peppers here, Capsicum annuum. And, yeah, chili peppers are rich in vitamin C. They stimulate blood circulation. And all of these things are, I think, interesting for people to know when they're mixing their spice blends, that when they add a bit of cloves, that it's interesting to know that cloves are used to treat asthma or bronchitis, nausea, vomiting, all of those kinds of things.
But, of course, Pat, the recipes in your book make that easy, right?
Absolutely.
Because you figured all that out. After you got back, you figured all that out.
I did.
Now, mastic, I don't have much association with that.
Mastic, we have in Canada, I live near Toronto, so a huge international population in Toronto. And so I have access to lots and lots of Indian and Middle Eastern stores where I can purchase sumac, for example, fresh turmeric, tamarind. All of these things are available to me in great quantity, but they're also available online. And I've found a number of great spice sellers who carry a lot of these interesting spices online.
Well, now, for those people who are not familiar with a tagine, tagine is indeed a cooking pot which has created a sort of a style of cooking that is uniquely Middle Eastern.
Absolutely. And it's fun because it's an interesting looking pot. It has two pieces. Bottom part is the part which we actually call the tagine pot because that's where the food is. And the top part looks like a Mexican hat. So it's a laid top that goes to a point, and that point has a specific purpose in cooking. So what happens in the bottom of the pot when you're cooking vegetables or meat or different combinations of ingredients, those ingredients sweat, and usually there's a bit of liquid in each recipe as well, and the liquid condenses as steam, it forms, hits the top of that point, it lid condenses, turns back into a liquid, and falls back down into the pot. So in actual fact, it's almost like it's raining inside there.
Right. As a result of that effect, that really has a very intriguing and satisfying way of cooking the dish.
Absolutely. So it, you get a wonder, you almost get a poached effect. You get a saucy, I've done, you know, my actually one of the very first recipes that I tested was using some chicken and some plums. So I just roughly quartered the plums along with some onions and some other ingredients. And the plums actually almost melted into the most fragrant and delicious sauce that I've ever really tasted. And the chicken is so tender you can almost cut it with a fork.
Right, so this is one of the magic tagine. But you've modernized this because you have a comparison of four different manufacturers, Avilari, Staub, and Le Creuset. I'm familiar with the fourth one, I honestly don't. But they all make a tagine which has a singular advantage for the modern cook.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's absolutely, you know, it's so wonderful that modern technology and modern techniques and modern ways of formulating these new cooking vessels have brought us to a point where we can have a traditional tagine pot, but using modern, you know, the stoneware and the cast iron that are used in these newer tagine pots can be used right on top of the stove.
Right, so you said they cooks quicker that way.
Yeah.
Well, this book offers not only the traditional and some modernized tagine, like one-pot meal things, it also offers up recipes for spice blends such as za'atar, which I've always bought pre-mixed, and now I can make my own. And also, you have some salads involved in here. You've integrated some of your vegetarian dishes in as well. And what other things do you offer here? You have tomato sauce, date molasses, chutneys, and anise marinade. Sounds heavenly.
It does. And I had a lot of fun because I was able to make a list of the typical Mediterranean fruit and vegetables, and then I was able to combine them in lots and lots of different ways, in soups and salads, in dessert, and I even have some interesting dessert tagines, and I also have some interesting dips.
Hummus you have, yes.
Hummus and tzatziki and roasted garlic and pepper pesto. Yeah. So I really had fun developing the recipes that would also surround the tagine recipes that were in the book.
Now, I have to ask you, Pat, because I have this theory that people are directed to careers as a result of their names. What's your relationship to Betty?
You know, it's so much fun. Isn't that fun? I do believe that people are, that their names can help, you know, not in every case, but can help to determine what they do. And
are there all these hairdressers named Kopf, which is head?
I know. And it's fun to find out, but you know, the root of the word crocker comes from the people who used to grow and pick saffron. So,
really, from crocus, I'll be darned.
Crocus sativa is the Latin name for the fall crocus that gives up its three stigmas for the saffron that we really love to cook with. And the people who actually harvested those
crocuses
were called crockers.
Well, I'll be darned. So you were preordained to be a cook.
And a culinary herbalist as well.
And a culinary herbalist as well.
This is an amazing book. If you have a tagine, then you must get this book. If you don't have a tagine, you should get a tagine because it's a great cooking book.
Exactly.
And then get the book so you'll know what to do with it. And you'll be sure to enjoy it. And thank you so much, Pat, for joining us today
at
On the Menu
pleasure.
Radio.
I've had so much fun.
Thanks, Pat. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And stay with us because we'll be right back after another short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And hello. You may find this next interview a bit arbitrary in terms of relationship to subject matter, but think it through. It's not too far remiss. It's the closest one we had. We didn't want too short a program here, and we found we had a wonderful interview all about goat.
A fascinating story about goat. I mean, truly fascinating. And we should really have put this at the beginning of the program. The guys are so interesting. But here we are talking about what is actually an essential ingredient in parts of Morocco anyway. Right? I suppose. Anyway, that's why it's here. So here's all about goats.
Well, this is a book after my heart because I happen to be one of those people who loves goat. It's titled Goat, Meat, Milk, and Cheese. And welcome Bruce Weinstein and Mark Scarborough to On the Menu.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, there are things that I really did not know. For example, that 70% of all meat consumed is goat in the world?
It is. Goat is, in fact, the world's most consumed meat. I know, most people...
Most people in North America wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole, so...
Many people wouldn't, but across the world, if you think globally, goat is the most consumed meat. And the amazing thing about goat is if you are concerned about factory farming, it has escaped largely factory farming and remained a cottage industry.
See, that I loved. You know, I never even thought about that until I picked up your book. That's an advantage right there.
It is. Even in South America where goat have eaten and across India and Asia, goat is still raised on small family farms as a cottage industry. And it's a terrific way of knowing you're supporting a local economy. If you're buying goat meat, even here, even if you get goat meat in the U.S., you know that you're one step closer to the farmer than if you're buying, you know, pork or beef.
Right. That chart, where is that chart that I saw? Was the other shocker about the calories?
Well, it's very much healthier, right?
Yes. Goat actually ounce per ounce, goat has fewer calories than beef, pork, or lamb, less fat, fewer grams of saturated fat, the whole lot. But what I think is equally exciting, I mean, maybe people know already that about beef, pork, and lamb, but goat has fewer calories and fewer grams of fat and fewer milligrams of cholesterol than chicken does.
Than chicken, yeah.
But it's also very good for you. I mean, it's not just a matter of it having less fat. It still has the same food value as nutrition.
Oh, of course. You're not losing any of the protein content or any of the nutrition content of eating a red meat. So it gives you all the nutrition of a red meat with much less of the bad stuff that you don't want in red meat. And on top of that, it's quite tasty. And it surprises me. We talked to people since we wrote the book, Goat, about eating goat meat, and they're like, oh, no, they're afraid of it because they think it's going to be too strong, or they've eaten it and they thought it was too strong, and there are two reasons that I always give them. First of all, goat should be mild. It should be soft, tender, sweet, and mild. I always say it kind of tastes like a cross between dark meat, turkey, and pork. And if you've had really strong and offensive-tasting goat, you probably were eating a very old goat. You're probably in the Caribbean on a cruise somewhere. You had some Jamaican jerk goat. And in Caribbean cultures, old, stinky goats are more the norm. So that's probably what happened. Or you were just fed not a meat goat. Maybe you had goat even in the States or North America and Canada, but you were fed an old dairy goat, which is really not a good way of eating goat.
Well, the first time I ever had goat milk was in Reading Terminal in Philadelphia. And I swear, it tasted exactly like how you described an old goat smelled.
Yes, and that's what Bruce said is one of the major problems in goat meat production still in this country. Dairy goats are not meat goats. And let's also say that there are also wool goats, angoras, and cashmeres out there. Those are not meat goats either. Meat goats are a specific breed of goat. And unfortunately, because goat is such a nascent industry in this country, some unscrupulous people butcher dairy goats for meat. It's not good meat in the same way that a dairy cow is not good beef.
Well, see, you explain all these things in this book. So you really help nudge the novice into
taking a stand on what they're buying.
Yeah.
And you also you point out the butchering tricks that the people, that the producers fall into time and time again, which is probably why, as you were saying before, you were butchering your own goats.
Well, right. I like to butcher my own animals whenever I have the opportunity, because then I can get exactly what I want. Because we also raise a pig every year, and I bring that to have somebody slaughter for it. And it's rare, it's the rare year when I can get them to cut it exactly the way I want. What pieces I want left on the bone, what I want boneless, I want the roast cut. So butchering it myself if I have the opportunity, and a goat is small enough that I can do that myself in the house. But I want to respond to your comment about goat milk tasting really strong like the barnyard. And that is not necessarily a function of goat milk. What that comes from is the bacteria quality and the bacteria count in the milk. And so the cleaner and more fastidious the dairy is, the more mild the milk is going to be.
Uh-huh. So we're talking God knows where it came from in Reading Terminal Market. Before that, slow food.
That could be, in fact, a problem. It's also a problem that goat milk producers can't let the buck around the does too much. And that also becomes a problem in the milk production. I mean, it's really the bucks, the male goats,
right,
that are really the offensive ones. And
I won't carry that further. I won't pursue that line at all.
And they are very. But I will say that in terms of eating goat meat and milk, there are, as Bruce indicated, there are some Caribbean cultures. We actually ran into some people on the island of Dominica in the Caribbean who were looking for the oldest, most offensive buck they could find to prepare for Easter dinner, because it's a tradition that they, you know, coat these things down in incendiary devices like chilies and the hot peppers. And they want really strong meat to stand up for that on Easter. That's their cultural tradition, but it's probably not the best way to experience goat the first time you ever try it.
Oh, it's like that French stuff. What is that sausage that's so vile?
Oh, merguez sausage?
Oh, no,
no,
merguez,
no. I think it's called andouette.
Andouette.
Oh, I love it.
You love it? Yeah, and you can smell it coming a mile away.
Yes, you can.
I had it once, and I mean, I like sausages, but I don't know that I would have sign up to have this every day.
I couldn't even get close to it.
Shall we put it that way? And the other people around the table who were with me having lunch said, "Why are you doing that? Why are you not having sweet-smelling goat?" Actually, I think they were eating lamb, but never mind.
Well, now, let's get into this. You cover the meat. You cover the preparations, the cooking time. You carefully explain what cuts can be cooked, what ways, to what temperature, the whole thing. And you get recipes from around the world, right?
Yes, I take inspiration for all my recipes from global cultures. So there are plenty of East Asian dishes. There's plenty of curry, South American dishes. There's Middle Eastern applications for goat meat and goat cheese. Whenever I'm creating recipes for any of our books, I like to take influence from global cultures.
That's for sure.
Another thing I think you've done that's interesting is you've substituted goat for other meats in recipes which are perhaps people's favorites, and you're saying, try this with goat and you'll like it even better, like chicken fried goat.
Yeah, there were a few examples where we did that. There are certain dishes where the dish would not be the same if it weren't with goat.
Okay, nice.
There's a Sally Boti, a curry.
Oh, I just was looking at that. Yeah.
That's made with apricots and almonds, which I have tried it with lamb, and I have tried it with other meats, and it's just not the same. It's really fantastic with the goat. But you're right, chicken fried goat, I wanted to try and see what would happen if I pounded down goat steaks really thin and battered them and deep-fried them, and they were quite fantastic. But rather than a traditional cream gravy, I use a goat milk gravy.
Oh, sure. Well, that just makes sense. I mean, it's called an adaptation, I guess.
There you go.
You also then move right along into recipes where you use the goat milk. And a lot of
sweet and savory. I mean, let me do it the other way. I'll have savory and sweet with goat milk, and even with goat cheese. You've made Danishes with goat cheese, right?
Yeah, that's right. Goat cheese in doughs and batters a lot. But one of the things that Mark and I found writing this book was that even the sweet dishes made with goat dairy aren't as sweet and cloying as a lot of sweet dishes made with cow dairy. And part of that is there is such a savory quality to goat dairy that it brings that savoriness even to dessert. So a goat cheese cheesecake isn't quite as overwhelmingly sweet as a cow cheese.
No, I can remember when we had goat butter from those Mayanbu people.
Oh, I love it.
It was a lot of fun to cook with.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot more interesting from a flavor perspective than using regular cow's milk butter.
It's not as sweet. Cow's butter is very sweet.
Can't we get more of this goat milk product stuff like the butter? I mean, who makes it besides Marienburg?
It's interesting that we don't have a lot of access to goat dairy and goat butter out there. The Marienburgs are the largest and only national distributors of goat milk products. You can find them in a lot of high-end stores and the butter, but it's not a national distribution network yet in the United States. One of the problems with goat milk is that the fat molecules are incredibly small. Actually, I shouldn't say that's a problem. It's actually good news because goat milk is very digestible. It ends up being the universal milk given to mammal babies in zoos whose mothers will not nurse them. And that's because the fat molecules are so small. But because they're so small, they're naturally homogenized throughout the milk. And so getting goat fat molecules out to make butter is a laborious process that involves lots of centrifugal and centripetal force and all that stuff
mm-hmm.
to pull it out of the milk, and can never pull it all out. So there will never be skim goat milk on the market because you can never get rid of all the fat.
Interesting.
It's too homogenized throughout.
Yeah, and I guess what you're saying is it's a laborious process, and as a result it's a relatively expensive process.
It's an extremely expensive process. That's really why you don't see, like, goat cream on the market. Anything that actually does come out. And the Marienburgers make goat butter because they do make a low-fat goat milk that they spin the fat out of. But you'd never see, like, Marienburg goat cream out there because every molecule they can get out of the milk, they're going to use to make butter with.
Right. Now, how about the goat milk ice cream lady, Lalouze?
Well, I don't think that she's so worried about getting the fat out of the cream.
Okay,
I think
right.
The fat out of the milk. I think she's just using the whole thing. Yeah, Laura Howard's goat milk ice cream is a spectacular product.
It is
really wonderful. Yeah, we loved it. We didn't give any of that away. Sometimes when we get ice cream, we tend to have fortunate friends and neighbors, but the Lalouze goat milk ice cream was totally consumed in-house.
Yeah, that one that she makes that's a strawberry goat milk ice cream with balsamic vinegar in it.
Oh, yes.
Unbelievable.
So, all right, so you've introduced the subject of goat for everybody who wants to explore a little further this whole avenue of what new to eat. You've written 18 books, I understand.
True. Actually, since Goat came out, 3 books published this year.
Now, that's amazing, isn't it? What are your other subjects?
We had a book published in the summer called Lobsters Scream When You Boil Them and 100 Other Myths About Food and Cooking.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then we had a just-published book from Cooking Light called The Complete Quick Cook, which is a manual on how to be a fast, efficient cook.
There we go. I need to swallow that one. I hope that one comes with a pill.
That would be interesting, in pill form. That would be great.
Now, I had one last question for you, and of course now I can't remember. Oh, do you have a blog that goes along with the goat book?
We don't have a blog that goes with a goat, but we do have a blog called Real Food Has Curves, like Real Women Have Curves.
Oh, yes. That's you. I didn't realize that.
That is us. But Real Food Has Curves is us because we just believe that real food in the real world doesn't have 90-degree angles and boxes.
Uh-huh.
There you go. Well, I think that listeners who were interested in blogging about goat will undoubtedly flock to that site.
Herd, I think, is the word.
Yeah. No, no.
Wrong animal.
Goats actually, I mean, there is a person called a goat herd, but I think I don't think it's a very successful occupation.
I doubt it.
I think goats sort of go where they want to, don't they?
Yeah.
They have
a mind of their own.
Yeah, you know, they had this really cute, they had pygmy goats on a video that were just adorable.
Oh, okay. Are we now talking about cooking pygmy goats? I think it might be time to end this interview here.
Well, guys, it's been the book is wonderful. It inspired me to go search for goats.
Well, we hope you do go search for goats.
Yeah, well, we had a local supplier, and he gave it up.
Well, you can. There is a list in the book of many places that will ship it to you frozen overnight, and that's how I get much of mine.
Okay.
It doesn't suffer in the freezing, and you can have it the next day.
And if you're fortunate enough to live near a Hispanic or a halal Middle Eastern market...
Yeah, we have one of those, yeah.
You can generally find goat there.
Yeah, I betcha.
Okay, well, Mark and Bruce, thank you so much for sharing your ideas.
A delight to meet you two.
Oh, thank you.
Our pleasure.
So let's close today's program by...
Wait a minute.
Isn't there
something really special about this 2012?
I don't know. There
in
is.
January 2012?
It's an Olympic year. What are you talking about?
This begins our 8th year of doing On the Menu.
Oh, there you go. Well, happy 8th anniversary, dear.
Yes, indeed.
And I'm sure we'll be here for a 9th and a 10th because we're just having so much fun. We hope you are too. And you'll join us again same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.